reform named the Good School by then Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. The reform radically transformed the Italian education system, introducing measures including granting more powers to principals, a new national recruitment process for teachers, and obligatory work experience programs for high school students.
The 2015 reform brought private interests into our schools. From that year onwards, the company's interests came first, not our preparation. The rat race had just begun.
The reform has legalized the exploitation of us students. We are obliged to work unpaid for businesses. It's completely useless and unfair.
Students at the rally said the initiative was also called to remember Lorenzo Parrelli, an 18-year-old boy who was crushed by a metal bar while on a school training placement at a factory in northern Italy a year ago.
Noi crediamo sia stato assassinato perché
Lorenzo was assassinated by the work placement program. He was working in a factory for free, with no safety measures in place. Two more people have died under that program and simply in the interest of the capitalistic economy.
Recently, an international family caused a stir by saying they had to leave Italy due to the appalling conditions of the education system. While schools vary around the country, statistics show that educational standards overall are consistently below the EU average.
Italy is the country in the European Union that invests the least in public education. According to data by the European Statistical Agency Eurostat, Italy allocates about 8% of its public spending in this field, placing it last after Greece and well below the EU average of about 10%. Max Civili, Rome.
Women scientists and cultural and high-ranking political figures from 28 countries across the globe gathered in the Iranian capital, Tehran, to celebrate the efforts and achievements of women worldwide in a conference dedicated to women of influence. The first of its kind, an initiative of Iran's First Lady, Jamile Alam-ul-Hoda, based on what used to be a ceremony limited to Iranian women in previous years. The conference was aimed at showing appreciation for women of influence while offering support and help for them to grow and promote their ideas, as Ensia Khazali, Iran's Vice President for Women and Family Affairs, stated in her opening remarks. With Anna Hakopian, the wife of Armenia's Prime Minister, emphasizing the important role women play in promoting tolerance and peaceful coexistence.
About 300 foreign guests are taking part in this conference, 70 of them female officials and politicians. The conference itself is held in three different levels: cultural, scientific, and a special panel for ministers and first ladies.
Morning and afternoon sessions were held to provide a platform for the participants in order to share their ideas and valuable experiences regarding the challenges that women face in today's world. The conference wrapped up with Iran's First Lady thanking her guests for supporting the initiative and a special ceremony where the Goharshad Prize was awarded to seven of the influential women, recognizing their outstanding performance and contributions. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Already in 2023, 30 refugees have drowned in the Mediterranean Sea as they attempted to reach the EU, according to figures from the United Nations. The EU's border and coast guard agency, Frontex, has in the past been lambasted for pushing back unsafe boats, resulting in deaths. On Thursday, the new head of the agency vowed to end this practice.
I am responsible for the fact that my people don't participate in anything called a pushback. So I think that is absolutely clear. That is the legal framework I work in. So that's it.
According to OLAF, the EU's anti-fraud office, at least 2,000 refugees drowned in the Aegean Sea during 2020 and 2021 as they were pushed back from the EU coastline by Frontex. The agency prevented at least 40,000 asylum seekers from reaching the EU, which blatantly breaks international law. In just 10 months, the EU has welcomed more than 4 million Ukrainian refugees, They are afforded all the same rights as EU citizens. However, if you're from a different part of the world, torn up by Western powers, it's a different story. We visited a shelter for Afghans in Brussels.
Before we come in the Europe, we think the Europe care about women, care about children. Now we come in here, not. They don't care about women, they don't care about children.
When the children go to school, they need food, they need clothes. And for everything, we need to work. So we need the job permit.
There are no such problems for Ukrainians. Of course, that's to be welcomed, but rights groups are asking why the discrimination. EU Home Affairs ministers will meet in Stockholm, Sweden next Thursday to agree on a more effective strategy to deport asylum seekers who don't meet refugee status criteria. Campaigners point out there are no plans to adopt a similar policy for refugees arriving here from Western Ukraine, arguably a relatively safe region. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Could the UK witness a renewed push by religious communities to remove a controversial relationship and sex education, also known as RSE lessons, in British schools? It appears the appetite is huge after an online petition on the UK government website rocketed to well over 130,000 signatures in just a few days.
The petition focuses on tackling just one aspect of RSE, which many parents find concerning, LGBT relationship education, which is a lifestyle not condoned by the three Abrahamic faiths. However, there is a growing anti-RSE movement, which is campaigning for the total removal of RSE from the state curriculum, as activists believe that it is parents who should be teaching their kids about this sensitive subject matter rather than state-funded teachers.
RSE is currently mandatory in British schools, teaching kids about relationships and sex education, including same-gender relations. The lessons have been marred with controversy, sparking Muslim-majority parent protests as far back as 2019. Parents alleged their kids were being indoctrinated by secular worldviews and what they call LGBT propaganda.
We believe that, that the subjects, they should be able to withdraw from this type of subject. So we, the No Outsiders campaign, so we just want to able to have control over what they are being taught.
Speaking to a local Muslim activist, Shakil Afsar explained why he feels the petition received so much support.
I think it would have got a lot more signatures if there wasn't this pro-LGBT narrative in our society where if you speak against them, you are completely shut down, locked up, and the keys thrown away. I think there would have been a lot more. And I think with the people who have signed, they are people who are at the forefront of understanding what's happening. There are many people who don't really understand the situation. They don't even really know what's happening until their children are coming home with these books. I believe that if there was a transparent media, this petition would have signatures in the millions.
So far, the protests have largely received negative coverage, with the establishment refusing to budge on the RSE curriculum. Activists believe this uncompromising stance could boil over to more parent protests in 2023. Robert Carter, London.
Yemenis are growing frustrated with the United Nations' failure to condemn the Saudi-led war on Yemen, or to hold them responsible for the ensued disastrous ramifications. This comes just days after the UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Hans Grundberg, addressed the United Nations Security Council about the situation in Yemen. While calling for an end to violence, Grundberg declined to condemn the ongoing Saudi artillery shelling that has killed or injured dozens of civilians in the northern province of Sada.
I call on the parties to respect international humanitarian law. Military activity, combined with negative rhetoric and escalatory political and economic measures, create a situation where a simple miscalculation could reignite a cycle of violence that will be difficult.
Grundberg also called for humanitarian aid to Yemen, but mentioned nothing about the lifting of the Saudi blockade, which is the main obstacle preventing vital aid and food supplies from entering the country. This military general we spoke with on the streets of the Yemeni capital says the United Nations is the root cause of all evil in Yemen.
They own the stories every country they get involved in. Look at what they did in Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Sudan. As for Yemen, the United Nations and all of its envoys' efforts in Yemen have been directed at spying on Yemenis, instigating conflicts among Yemenis and fueling chaos and instability.
Some Yemenis are calling on their government to abandon all political talks with the UN. They accuse the UN of complicity with the Saudi-led coalition in the killing of Yemenis. The Yemeni government stated that if the blockade is not lifted and salaries are not paid, the only option left is war. The Yemeni people and government have expressed that the 8-year Saudi-imposed siege on Yemen must be broken by any means necessary. This after years of failed political efforts to resolve the conflict by the United Nations, an entity which most Yemenis lost trust in and accuse of supporting the Saudi military aggression on Yemen. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Tehran has hosted the first International Congress on Influential Women. The 2-day event is underway in the Iranian capital with the participation of influential, active and elite women from almost 90 world countries. Addressing the Congress, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi called on the participating women at the Congress to benefit from the experiences of the Islamic Republic of Iran with regard to women's rights.
We hope that the participants of this Congress, through cooperation and interaction, will be able to take necessary measures for the rights of women in the world and benefit from the experiences of the Islamic Republic of Iran in the field of protecting women's rights and paying special attention to women's role in the society. I hope this Congress will prepare the ground for further cooperation among countries in this field.
The event is aimed at identifying, supporting and developing the abilities and capabilities of elite and influential women at national and international level.
Women are suffering worldwide. This is just because we have not been together. And most importantly, this is the very first time for the Islamic country of Iran to host such a big occasion. So I am so happy to be here, and I hope the relationship with our sisters, women in the world, we should work hard, very strongly, and look forward to the international world to assist women than ever before.
It is extremely important to integrate women in the peace-building process. So this conference is extremely important because we know that we have a peace threatened in many parts of the world. And when we look for solutions, women should be involved.
Special awards with international recognition are slated to be granted to influential women in 3 fields of science and technology, economic and social affairs.
The Congress International of the Women, it's very important for the women in the Islam. For the development, the communication, the country, for example, Algeria, the woman Algeria and the woman Iraq, and it take the relation very important because the Islam it's number one.
The influential women have been selected from among housewives, women employees, female social activists, as well as competent women in digital technology, social media, science and technology, entrepreneurship, and those who are pioneers in areas of culture and charity affairs.
On the sidelines of the Congress, a memorandum of understanding was signed among Afghanistan's neighboring countries at the initiative of Iran's Vice President for Women and Family Affairs to help Afghan girls and women continue their education. Sama Kujuri, Tehran.
The heads of the main EU institutions defended the 27-nation bloc's foreign policy during a debate in the European Parliament on Wednesday. They insisted that sending deadly weapons to Ukraine, costing billions of euro, is the only way to thwart Russia. Most lawmakers agree, but not all.
We see militarization, we see escalation. We are not really seeing a call for peace. We assume it will be the people who suffer the cost of sanctions.
Interest rates continue to rise in the Eurozone and inflation remains extremely high. Sanctions against Moscow and the rapid move away from Russia's energy are the main reasons.
The cost of the living crisis affecting our European citizens unfortunately persists, and we are therefore concerned that the European Council conclusions fail to prioritise the support for our citizens.
Experts warn public support in the EU for the seemingly never-ending cash flow to Ukraine will eventually wane if the war persists, resulting in political consequences.
There can be a kind of danger, which is already looming, that very populistic parties, they can use this as an argument to say, look, this is something we have to cater for our own needs first, and then we have to see what's going to happen in Ukraine.
In an unprecedented departure from diplomacy on Wednesday, the European Council President Charles Michel accused authorities in Iran of operating a, quote, brutal regime. He says more sanctions against Tehran will be announced on Monday. Some lawmakers oppose the policy.
The EU and its partners never stop violating international law, going above multilateral institutions like the UN with their own parallel systems, including punishing millions of people around the world through our authoritarian unilateral sanction regime.
By insisting that rioters in Iran are peaceful protesters and by attempting to directly implicate the Islamic Republic in the Ukraine war, impartial analysts say the EU is being opportunistic, suggesting the new sanctions are trumped up and politically motivated. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
From hero to zero, and claps don't pay the bills. Some of the chants by nurses here and across the country on strike again in a dispute with government over not just pay, but patient safety. Emma has been a nurse for more than three decades.
For a long time, we've felt we haven't been able to give the care we want to give because we're so pressed for time, resources, simply just numbers on the ground. So I think for a long time, we've wanted things to change, and it's come to the point where this something has to change, and this is really our only option. Nothing else is working.
The reason behind that, more than 10 years of underfunding and neglect.
Across the country, the health service has been facing what's been described as an intolerable and unbearable strain due to a combination of COVID, the seasonal flu, and staff shortages, with some patients having to wait up to 24 hours for a bed inside a hospital such as this one.
That plus a record 7 million patients on the NHS waiting list, described as a national scandal. The Royal College of Nursing Union demanded a 19% pay rise when they first went on strike last year, but has since cut that in half. Yet a deal is yet to be reached. The Health Secretary, James Cleverly, says the strikes put patients' lives at risk. Last week, the government introduced legislation that, if passed, will enable employers to sue unions and fire employees if they refuse to work on strike days.
Rather than talking about the pay negotiation, talking about safer staffing and the safety and quality of care that we're giving up and down the country in our hospitals, the government have gone down this sort of anti-strike, anti-trade union route. So once again, so it's interesting to talk about safe staffing levels on a strike day, but what about the other 365 days in the year when we have not enough nurses on duty, not enough doctors, not enough physiotherapists, cancellations of operations and delayed chemotherapy? What about those days? What about safer staffing on a normal NHS day?
The UK has been hit by months of public sector strikes from rail to mail, all of whom say they're in for the long haul. In the weeks ahead, more strikes are planned by nurses, paramedics, and ambulance drivers, with the Royal College of Nursing warning it'll be their biggest walkout yet if pay talks with the government do not progress soon. Saeed Purza, London.
The Zionist regime bombed Gaza's only power plant in 2006, starting a crisis that has continued ever since. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The electronic intifada, quoting from Amjad Ayman Yaghi, a journalist based in Gaza, wrote, "I vividly remember when our electricity crisis began. On June 28, 2006, the Israeli regime bombed Gaza's only power station. For me, then aged 16, the bombing was a source of frustration and disappointment. I had been watching the World Cup that month, cheering for Argentina, one of my favorite teams at international level. 2 days after the bombing, Argentina played Germany in a quarterfinal. I was unable to watch the match on TV. My sense of disappointment soon grew into something bigger. Life in Gaza was completely changed by the bombing. For everyone, the question of how to find enough power for our daily needs became a preoccupation. It was the main topic of conversation. We quickly grew obsessed about how to light our homes. Candles sold out quickly, so we often had to use flashlights. We started to rely on the radio for news and entertainment. Rather than watching football matches, I listened to commentary on them. In 2008, I had to sit the Tawjihi, the final high school exams. It was very difficult to concentrate as I studied in the evenings. I constantly heard the noise of generators. They were very loud. My grandmother told me to imagine that the noise was from a party. She was essentially saying that the situation had been imposed on us by the Zionist regime and we couldn't do anything about it. Occasionally, I went to a park near Beach refugee camp in Gaza City. It had a light, so I would try and study there. Many other students tried to prepare for exams under the few street lights. Some even depended on the lights from passing cars. Everything got worse during Operation Cast Lead, a major Israeli regime assault on Gaza in late 2008 and early 2009. For 10 days, my family, Ayman said, had no electricity at all. He added, "Our supply of water was cut off too. We need electricity so that water can be brought to our homes. We tried our best to find water and fuel, particularly gas. Operation Cast Lead lasted for more than 3 weeks. We got some power back after what, but the electricity crisis that began in 2006 had never been properly resolved. Somehow, we survive. Now, we depend a great deal on rechargeable batteries, especially for lighting and for the internet. There is scarcely a home in Gaza without batteries. There are some large generators in various parts of Gaza and we pay subscription fees for them. The fees are a major strain on the finances of many families. While the small generators proved vital in the early stages of the crisis, we use them less today. In 2019, I traveled to Egypt and Jordan for the first time. It came as something of a shock to see that the supply of electricity was uninterrupted in both countries. I didn't experience any of the power cuts that had become so routine in Gaza. To my amazement, it took much less time than normal, bearing in mind that nobody should view the Gaza situation as normal, to recharge my cell phone and laptop. There have been some changes in Gaza. Over the past few years, most people have stopped using candles to light their homes. The avoidance of candles followed a number of horrific incidents. Children have been burned to death in cases where rooms lit by candles went on fire. power shortages have caused major problems for the Gaza economy too. Samir Abu Asmamud, 48, is a carpenter and one of many people from Gaza who used to commute between here and the occupied Palestinian territories for work. That stopped in 2000 when the Israeli regime military withdrew a work permit for him, citing security reasons. Abu Asmamud then opened a small carpentry workshop in Gaza. Since the electricity crisis began in 2006, he has found it extremely difficult to process orders for furniture. On many occasions, he did not have enough money to settle bills for timber and other materials. Unable to pay debts between 2019 and last year, Abu Asmamud was jailed several times, he said. Many people in Gaza have gone out of business because the electricity keeps cutting out. Fuel is expensive and generators are often out of order. In Gaza, we sometimes call those born since the power crisis began the electricity generation. This crisis cannot be separated from the complete blockade the Israeli regime imposed on Gaza in 2007 because that siege has robbed so many opportunities from so many people we sometimes call those born in the lost generation. My 16-year-old cousin, Shadi Mohanna, is part of the electricity or lost generation. He said, I used to think that everyone in the world was suffering from wars and electricity and water shortages. I even thought the Israelis had the same problems. I was shocked to learn the opposite. As well as Jordan and Egypt, I have traveled to Turkey and Sudan. There are many social problems, including serious poverty, in all of these countries, but they have electricity. Gaza's power crisis has persisted because the Zionist regime is subjecting us to the kind of blockade you can read about in history books about Middle Ages, though with the help from advanced weapons, many supplied by the US. When will we finally be treated as human beings?
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Another mass shooting in the U.S. 10 people have been killed in L.A. near a Chinese lunar celebration event. What has become a staple of life in America, it appears. And the question still remains, why does America tolerate mass shootings that are taking place due to firearm possessions? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at this recurring crisis there and what role the gun lobby, the NRA, has, along with why U.S. politicians and the U.S. president himself have failed to stop this phenomenon. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the program. Richard Becker, an anti-war activist from Answer Coalition, joins us from San Francisco. Also joining us, Margaret Kimberly, co-founder of the Black Agenda Report, who joins us from New York. Welcome to you both. Another sad day for the U.S. when it comes to mass shootings there, Richard Becker. 10 dead in gun violence near the Chinese Lunar Year celebrations. And the way that this was described was a shooter with a machine gun carrying a large number of rounds, or carrying a number of rounds of ammunition so that he could reload, is what how he was sighted during action. What is your initial reaction to this?
Well, it's horrific. It's just horrific. And, you know, we've seen the mass killings now in Uvalde, in Buffalo, very near where I was from originally, but all over the country. And it's true that I think there's been 30 already in this year, in 2023. And, you know, it's a... You also have to think when we hear this is the latest reports and we see these terrible casualties and the injuries of those who survive, life-changing injuries in many cases. And, you know, immediately what I was thinking today was thinking back to 2005 when George W. Bush passed a law that was called the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act. And what it did was basically say that the arms makers are exempt. They are protected by the federal government from being having any responsibility for what their products are used for. And there's no doubt that they know what their products are being used for, because the huge number of weapons that are being produced and sold inside of the United States are bound to end in like what we've seen again today. And the U.S. government has protected, it has carved out protections. It is carved out protections for the arms makers. It's carved out protection from criminal liability or going to jail for any of those responsible for the opioid crisis. It protects the rich and the big corporate interests. And then says that, you know, the leaders come back and talk about, you know, people who have suffered these losses and these tragedies are in our thoughts and prayers. I mean, it's the cynicism is incredible.
Okay, since you talked about the number of arms being produced or guns being produced, I have to then go to that stat, because stats speak for themselves. So, Margaret Kimberly, the gun ownership in the U.S., it says, based on the latest, that the U.S. ratio of 120.5 firearms per 100 residents, which is up from 88 per 100 in the year from the year 2011. But then more interestingly was when the NRA, based on a simple Google search, which is that National Rifle Association, in information related to that, it said that the number of privately owned firearms has more than doubled from about 192 million to more than 405 million. 405 million, including more than 167 million handguns. Okay, so there's money in it, there's profits that are being made, but the fact that these gun manufacturers are exempt from accountability, they have to be protected. Are we looking at the NRA being that modem or that channel for their protection?
Well, you know, they're not the only corporate interests that are protected from any liability. Vaccine makers are protected from liability. Airlines have great protection from liability. They don't even have to protect the country when they don't schedule flights and cancel flights. So it's part of what's happening in this country where corporate interests are in control. We have an oligarchy in this country, so it could be the NRA, it could be Big Pharma, it could be any number of entities. But the big problem here goes back to the beginnings of American history. This is a settler colonial state, and this mentality that this is a country to be conquered, that other people are to be subjugated, is one that still resonates with millions of people. I also think that as this country is a failed state, that is the hard truth of the matter, as conditions, living conditions for people deteriorate, as people become more and more insecure economically, I believe those people who are frail psychologically are inspired to act on their worst impulses. And I think every incident leads to another. These people who need help inspire one another. So when there's one mass shooting, another generally follows fairly quickly. And so I think this combination of this mentality that says it's okay to be violent, it's beneficial to be violent, and you can't separate the domestic from the international. You can't have a country with a huge military budget which claims the right to kill people all around the world. You cannot be surprised when individuals feel like they have the right to kill when they want to.
Okay. I'm interested in your you mentioned psychological problems. I'm interested as to why you chose that to being one of the factors for what you just said.
Well, I think it's obvious. There are people, many people in this country who are just unhinged, who are, it's not a technical term, who are out of their minds. And I think the combination of the deterioration in life, for example, there are fewer and fewer living wage jobs. The safety net that we have is always threatened. People can't count on work. They can't count on having the ability to care for themselves. There's more and more insecurity. And I think when you combine that with people who, I mean, and they always exist, do they not? People who need mental health care. And then you combine that with this country that's historically been very violent and where the political system protects this type of violence and others. These people now are, I believe, inspired. And when you don't handle it, when there was no crackdown, then, of course, each one inspires the next.
All right. So let's dive into that issue if we can, because it's pretty shocking, Richard Becker, what our guests there touched on when it comes to the number of deaths overall, which needs to be mentioned here. We're looking at 40,000 roughly, or between 40 to 45,000 that are dying every year in the U.S. because of firearms in one form or another, which translates into more than 110 Americans that die every day, okay? But what's very shocking and at the same time very interesting, but more shocking than that, is with the breakdown. When you take a look at the breakdown, you have a little over 19,000 based on the homicides that happen, but 24,000, which is more than homicides, is because of suicides. That's pretty shocking. I mean, I don't know if many people are aware of that. They know that U.S. is a dangerous place, and of course, firearms is a problem that the U.S. has. But not many people, I think, are aware that it's because of suicides. Are the reasons given? First of all, what do you think of that? Are the reasons given there by our guest Margaret reasons for people to take their lives? And what does that say about the state of mental health of many Americans in the U.S.?
Well, yes, I completely agree with what Ms. Kimberly said. And the you know, we live in a very atomized society. People are on their own. And if you're lucky and, you know, you have a good income and, you know, your family has stability and so forth, you know, still you can run into a lot of problems. But if you don't have those things, and particularly if you don't have income, if you become...
Richard Becker, I think we lost you. Okay, let me go to you, Margaret Kimberly. Margaret Kimberly, we were talking about this shocking stat about the suicides, which you touched on. Now, based on what we're looking at, there are pros and cons on this. Advocates for these stricter gun laws say that, you know, you need to have lawmakers devoting some resources for people in order to prevent them from taking their lives with firearms. At the same time, you have gun control opponents who have framed the gun violence as a symptom of a broader mental health problem. Which obviously shows that there's a crisis there, and it's not the life being taken away is not due to the firearm, it's due to the person. What would you say to them?
Well, I think it's both. You know, we have these people have easy access to these guns with large magazines, which can fire many bullets, which no one, I believe, has any reason to own. There's no reason. These are military grade weapons, and anyone can get their hands on them when there's no justification for it. Now, the opponents of gun control will say that they may be a marksman or it's target shooting or hunting. I don't understand why these cannot be regulated. But the NRA, an organization I do not support at all, has a lot of support around the country. So I think it's a combination of two things. The statistic you gave about how many gun fatalities are caused by suicides is a huge number.
Right.
And I think to the point I was making before, that's something that isn't talked about very much, the suicides that happen with guns. But as the other guest said, we have this atomized society, people on their own, worsening economic conditions, a political system that does not address the needs of the people, but only addresses the needs of the oligarchy. All of these things combine to create a kind of thinking among millions of people, people who see other people as their enemy, people who don't see any common cause with others, and then may have mental health problem. And then, of course, when it's not taken care of, when nothing changes, each act inspires the next one. So I hate to say this, but it's inevitable that we're going to have these mass shootings until something changes. But we live in a society where the system doesn't help the people in so many other ways, so we should not be surprised about this either.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, we have Richard Becker back with us also. Richard Becker, when you had that school shooting that happened in Texas that left 19 children dead and two adults also as part of that, basically 21 people to have been killed, it was very, it's very telling what the U.S. President Joe Biden said when he said, or posed as a question when he said, when are we going to stand up to the gun lobby? What does that say about the gun lobby?
Well, the gun lobby is quite powerful. I mean, the many, many politicians have received $1 million or multi-million dollar donations over the years. Mitt Romney, who's considered one of the moderate Republicans, I think is the leader with more than $13 million in donations from the gun lobby. And, it's very true that a huge number of weapons are already dispersed in the population. And in order to begin to halt this, there has to be consequences for the gun makers. And there haven't been. When the opioid makers like Purdue Pharmacy would send a million opioid pills to a town of 300 people, they didn't think that, somehow those were all going to be used for pain purposes, or that there were going to be those kind of health problems in that town that required that number. No, they knew that this was going to go into the market, into the illegal market. to the black market and become immensely powerful and immensely profitable. And it did. And the same thing goes for the weapons makers. They know that these guns that are being distributed in such vast quantities throughout the United States and such an increase in the number of guns in circulation domestically, that that's going to mean more mass shootings, more mass killings. But they are protected. They are protected the same way mm-hmm. that, so, as Margaret Kimberly mentioned, so many other industries are, so many other capitalist industries are.
Okay, the question of accessibility is very important over here. Now, some thought when Joe Biden signed that historic law that's said to be the one of the strongest, if not the strongest, gun control laws last year was going to somehow put a dent into what has occurred in terms of mass shootings or firearms, deaths as a result of firearms, but that did not happen. So, you know, they're asking for some of the proposals, stricter gun control laws, universal background checks to be stronger, or banning certain types of weapons. Okay, these are all sound good, but they haven't worked, even though there's been strides made in it. But the question of accessibility, I think, is the bigger problem. And Margaret Kimberly, I don't know what part of New York you are at, but I'm sure you're familiar with the Bronx. And I'm going to just name an example. Co-op City in the Bronx, and this is a real example of the way guns are accessible. Co-op City in the Bronx, one of the streets that is not even in a very bad neighborhood. You have people that are just hanging out, and you can go to them and say, "What's up?" They say, "What do you need?" And if you say you need a handgun, they come back and tell you, "We'll have it for you within the hour." Okay, that's the reality of what's going on in the streets. How can that then be stopped? I mean, you know, what can the police do? Because it goes back to the streets and the U.S. being awash with guns. So there needs to be a breaking point there. How can that be addressed?
Well, it's interesting. I'm in New York City. It's interesting you mentioned New York. You know, handgun laws vary by state. And New York State has very strict gun laws, except guns come from other states that aren't very far away. So if you go, I don't know, drive 4 or 5 hours away to Virginia, which has a very loose gun regulations, almost none, that is where people get guns and then bring them back to New York.
What do you mean none? I'm sorry to jump in. Why loose and why none? That doesn't make sense, does it?
Because people, it not doesn't make sense to me, but there are people across the country who they don't want gun regulations. This is something where there is a divide, a popular divide, and there are places where people believe in their right to bear arms, as they call it, their right to own firearms as powerful as they want, as many as they want. And the people who own guns actually own a lot of guns, which is why there's so many per person, at least one per person. So you have people in these states, people run for office promising not to enact gun legislation. So you have part of the population who is quite who are quite happy not to have any regulations, but their decisions impact those of us, like in New York, who do want gun regulation. So people can come to New York City, to the Bronx, to Brooklyn, to any part of the city with guns from other places, and they can do with them what they whatever they choose. So even in a state which has stricter laws, handguns are still very easily accessible, even though that access is not legal.
So is that the case, Richard Becker? I mean, based on your viewpoint, that I don't know what is it like in San Francisco, but that you can maybe travel outside of San Francisco, maybe go to some part of L.A., maybe go to, projects where the guns might be available there on the streets readily if you were to peruse the neighborhood. And for the right price, get one. Is that how it stands? Because you two are at the opposite end of the U.S., one in the east, one in the west.
Yeah, and you know, I have to say, I'm from upstate New York, western part of New York State. I haven't lived there in a long time, but I knew a lot of people. I didn't do hunting myself, but I knew a lot of people who were hunters. You don't go hunting with a semi-automatic rifle or a handgun. That's illegal to do. That's not what it's for. So you have to ask, well, what is it for? What are they producing What is the and a lot of the gun industry, by the way, is based in Connecticut. A lot, and they're very powerful in Connecticut politics. And so they're shipping out all these weapons that, you know, supposedly have some good purpose for them, or, you know, healthy purpose. And they know they're not. They really know that. In as far as California goes, San Francisco, okay, San Francisco probably has less guns per capita than the average city. I'm pretty sure it does. But there are gun shows. There's not only gun dealers, there's gun shows. You know, you can go to Walmart and get guns, and gun shows happen. And one of the things that the gun lobby has resisted is having strict background checks at gun shows, where, you know, they'll be like hundreds of gun makers or gun dealers, not the makers, but the dealers more, in like a big place, like a convention center. And people go around, they look at them, and they buy them. And, you know, there can be some background checks, but it's very, very loose and easy to avoid any limitations on your ability to gain weapons, either in the black market, either, you know, illegally or legally.
Even politicians have not been immune to this, Margaret Kimberly. I was looking down a list of U.S. Congress members killed or wounded in office, and I'm quite surprised that it goes all the way back to the year 1789. I'm not going to rehash all the different congressmen, which is broken down by their party affiliation. However, you know, what comes to mind is when Reagan, for example, was shot, or you have other instances of U.S. politicians that are not immune from guns. And yet, the U.S. is still looking at this being a problem. So where do you go from here? I mean, you know, here's another mass shooting, 10 people to have been killed. I'm sorry to say, I think it's going to happen again. And I'm sure that's what people in the administration are telling each other. But then what are they going to do about it?
Well, it's interesting. You quoted President Biden, who said, when are we going to do something? As if he has nothing to do with what sort of legislation is passed in the country as president. But he knows, having been in politics for decades, he knows that there's a lot of support for the right to own any gun you want, as powerful as you want. He knows it would be tough politically to do.
Margaret Kimberly.
Paid responsibility.
My bad. We're just out of time. I did not note the time there, but I do apologize. Margaret Kimberly, co-founder of the Black Agenda Report. Thank you anyways. Richard Becker, thank you. Anti-war activist from the Answer Coalition. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitavoy and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.